Trump delayed his ultimatum to the Iranians and said, hey, I'm going to give you more time. Instead of having this big strike on Monday night, he said, how about 5 more days? Because there's some good signs diplomatically and that there's maybe the Iranian side is going to listen to us. So let's see if we can figure this out before we have to go any further down the road to war. Now, the people in his orbit in the Western media have been really doubling down on supporting everything President Trump has said and telling everybody, don't listen to anything that anybody else says, especially the Iranians. Everything they say is a lie. So just listen to us right here. Well, meantime, there were some other things that went along with this delay in the ultimatum that was given. And one has to wonder, was this part of the plan? There was a trade made right before all these drops came, and it happened at 7:30 a.m., 7:23 a.m. to be specific, on Monday morning when President Trump changed his mind to try to figure out what's going on with all this and where is all this headed and what can we expect as a result. We have Colonel Douglas McGregor back with us, defense and foreign policy analyst, former advisor to the Secretary of Defense, highly decorated combat veteran, and big-time friend of the show. Doug, welcome back as always.
Good to be with you.
Well, listen, let's just jump right into the elephant in the room, because there's a lot of things we have to discuss today. But I think that too few people are paying attention to a monster deal that just kind of got a little bit of news. Gary had the headline up there a minute ago, but it's almost been subsumed with all this talk about where the war is going and what may happen on Friday, et cetera. And I don't want to run too far past this too quick. Oil traders bet millions minutes before Trump's Iran talk postponement was initiated, making it pretty clear that somebody knew what was coming and was prepared to economically benefit. What can you tell us?
Well, I think we have to understand that we're dealing with Hunter Biden levels of corruption now in the Trump White House. Let me explain why. You put the oil trade up there. There was a bet that the price of oil would tank. And that was a bet of about $150 million. Another bet was placed that the market would lift, in other words, rise dramatically. That was a $1.5 billion bet. Now, whenever you bet in the market, which is effectively what it's about, it's a big casino. you know, for those who are only in it for casino purposes, as opposed to others that draw income from it over time. What we need to understand is that you bet less on the downside and bet more on the upside. So the $150 million bet paid off because somebody within 3 or 4 minutes of President Trump's announcement knew what President Trump was going to announce. The same thing was true for the $1.05 billion bet that you've got up there now. Both of these bets paid off handsomely. Now, who in the White House could possibly have known, and who in the White House has access to that kind of capital that could have a stupendous impact on profits? Well, I'll let everybody in the audience sort of let that sink in, think about it, and understand that in a normal setting, were this to happen, I would say 50 years ago, 100 years ago, maybe even 30 years ago, the Attorney General would be sitting at his desk or her desk and receive a note saying, we have witnessed this unnatural market behavior that's resulting in mega profits. And it all seems to come right before the president makes an announcement. We feel this justifies an investigation. Well, I don't think with Pam Bondi in there, there's any chance of that investigation happening on the executive side. Now, then the question is, well, what about Congress? Will someone in Congress stand up and say, look at this, this is outrageous? Maybe, but it's unlikely that it will gain much traction because the population of people that sit on the Hill in Congress are busy with insider trading. In other words, everyone in Washington is profiting one way or another from the disasters that are unfolding in front of us on the Hill and here, you know, in the Middle East and here at home. So I really, really want the MAGA crowd to pay attention to this, because they've been taken in badly by this president, misused, abused, and exploited. They need to wake up and understand the kind of Hunter Biden level of corruption that they're dealing with in the Trump White House.
And you know, the question's got to be, and that headline Gary had up there a second ago talked about, this is not the first time this has happened. There's been a number of times where pronouncements made by the White House had this mysterious market trading where somebody made millions of dollars, and yet I haven't seen a single investigation at all so far, to your point exactly. And it just looks like this has become some kind of legalized, I don't know if extortion is the right word, but certainly corruption. But it's not hidden, though. That's the thing. This is out in the open. I mean, what can happen? What can anybody do to try and bring some accountability or at least shine a light on what's actually going on and who is benefiting?
Well, this really reflects a level of contempt for the masses of American citizens who are struggling to make ends meet. You have to stop and consider that. You're talking about people in the White House, many of whom are billionaires, who have access to this kind of capital, along with, I would imagine, brigades of attorneys to protect them from prosecution. And they're exploiting their position to enrich themselves. I think their attitude is, well, that's what we do. That's how we got to be billionaires. We didn't all sit around in New York City and twiddle our thumbs. So I think that's part of the problem. But imagine the contempt that must exist for the American people in general for this sort of thing to go on as blatantly as you point out it has. This is an open and shut case on corruption. There's no question about it. But will it be investigated? I don't think so, for the reasons that I just outlined. There's no incentive to do it inside the executive branch. There's no incentive to do it on the Hill. Now, let's pause for a second and understand something. A very similar event occurred in 1781 in France. That's 8 years before the revolution breaks out in 1789. And a man named Necker was the French Minister of Finance. He put together a budget. It was actually a very good budget. It was an attempt to deal with the overspending, the mismanagement of funds by Louis XIV's cabinet and ministers. It failed. It failed because the aristocracy, in other words, the elites, were using their position to monetize whatever came out of the budget to steal money, effectively. And Necker did his best, but he couldn't make it work, and ultimately his budget was defeated. My point is that 8 years later, you get the French Revolution. We all know what happened at that point. And let's put it this way, the rewards for this kind of corruption and deceit were pretty serious. And the people involved in this, the vast majority of which went to the guillotine, were ultimately destroyed. And the French nation never really completely recovered from it. And it struggled for many, many years. And I think we're in danger of something like that happening here, because too many people are beginning to notice. Most Americans, most of the time, are willing to impute good intentions to the people in Washington. Big mistake in my judgment, but they are. They ought to look at this and understand, forget it. There's no altruism inside the Beltway. Everything, unfortunately, is treated as an opportunity for self-enrichment and profit. Think long and hard about that as you contemplate this entire war that's been developing in the Persian Gulf.
Right. Yeah. And I'm just about to get to that, but I want to bring up one more point. You say that more people are starting to notice. This is just a couple of hours ago. This is the BBC. Oil traders bet millions minutes before the Trump's Iran talks. And then you look a little bit further. It says the BBC has contacted the White House for comment. A spokesman told Financial Times that they did not tolerate any administration official illegally profiteering on insider trading knowledge. But yet then they go on to describe, you know, however, once the timing happened and these stocks happened, you're talking hundreds of millions of dollars were made. So I think that this, again, gets to your point there. It's like contempt. It's like, yeah, we're going to do this out in the open. It's in the market and you can't hide this kind of stuff. And then when the money comes in and people start asking, we just say, oh, we don't tolerate that. We don't do that here. And then moving on to the next thing. And then Trump will just move on to the next crisis, et cetera. And I'll be shocked if Pam Bondi investigates this. I mean, don't have to look much further, and we got to say it, than the Epstein files, all this talk and all this kind of stuff and all these things that have been released. And yet not one person has even been investigated or brought up on charges, much less anybody paid account for the thousands of people that were victims to this. And it's just looking more and more like the administration is not accountable to anyone. Is there a way out of this besides, as you said, something like 1789?
I don't think so. You know, I really don't. I wish there were. And I think if you stand up and you point to something that's fundamentally wrong, that's an exercise in corruption, you end up like Thomas Massie or Marjorie Taylor Greene or any number of people. Massie has hundreds of millions of dollars at work to destroy him, to prevent him from returning to his office in Washington. Marjorie Taylor Greene was afraid that something might happen to her family. She left. My point is, I don't see another way out. And I don't think we can elect ourselves out of this problem. And, you know, we've been down this road before. How many times do you vote and discover what you thought you were going to get is not what you got at all? In other words, we vote, we always get the same outcome. John McCain is president. So I think that's where we are. And there is no easy way out, just as there's no easy way out for President Trump in the Persian Gulf.
And that's kind of where I want to go with this down here, to kind of to really to highlight the risk that you're talking about. Obviously, President Trump ran on no stupid wars. I'm going to end the wars that are on the table. No more regime change, et cetera. All these things. And he has just done them in spades more than anyone else in the modern era has done before him, despite running exactly on that. So we definitely didn't get what we want. And then now here we are trying to get this war off. Now, whether his delay on this alleged ultimatum was always designed to support this, that we can only speculate on. But let's take a look at what the ramifications are, because it's only been delayed. It hasn't been stopped. He didn't take the ultimatum off the table, so the risks are still there. Here he was last night trying to explain why actually he had to do this, because they, the Iranians, posed a systematic threat to America.
We're systematically dismantling the regime's ability to threaten America. They're not threatening us anymore. As Commander-in-Chief, it's my sacred responsibility to protect our country from all threats. For decades, Iran refused every opportunity to renounce its nuclear ambitions, and in recent months, its own negotiators bragged to our representatives about having enough material to make nuclear weapons. And that was supposed to deter me, but it didn't deter. It made me more anxious, and it just made it much more important. This mission that we're all on together was much more important, and we did it quicker.
Okay, let's take a look at a few things you said there. Let's start with the first thing, that he said that they no longer pose a threat to us anymore. And if they don't pose a threat, then why is the Strait of Hormuz still closed, and why is there still a threat that you're going to strike their energy on Friday?
Well, Dan, first we need to correct a misnomer here. The Straits of Hormuz are not closed. They simply aren't. If you have oil sitting on a tanker right now in the Persian Gulf and you want to move it through the Straits of Hormuz, you have to demonstrate that the oil was paid for with yuan, not dollars. And then secondly, that oil is not going to either a U.S. ally or the United States or Israel. So if those conditions are met, you can move through the Straits of Hormuz. Now, they're not moving through at the rate they previously did, but it's wrong to say the Straits are closed, not for the Chinese, not for India, not for the Japanese. The Japanese have already met with the Iranians, as did the Indians, and they've hammered out their own agreements along the lines that I just described. So it's not closed. It's closed to us, our allies, and Israel, but not otherwise.
Yeah, and you can actually see that this is from today. This shows that traffic authorized by Iran is indeed moving. It is definitely slower, but it only benefits them, and it does not. It still is blocked for anything that we have. That just shows you it's a lot less than it was, but something is moving. But then the next thing he said is that the other thing he's justifying the war itself, and then with the continuation, is that it says Iran has for decades refused to get rid of their nuclear weapons program. But I mean, just right off the top, you can think, well, there was that little thing in 2015 where they literally had a negotiated into the capability to have a nuclear weapon. And then the opportunity that, again, we'll just compress everything else, the 2 days before this war happened, where they said they would go to zero enrichment. So literally they had everything on the table. And of course, at all points, they have declared they have no nuclear weapons program, and our intelligence confirmed it. So what do you make of his claim there, contrary to all the evidence that we can actually see?
I think it's time to dismiss almost anything that comes out of his mouth as probably fundamentally false. It's depressing to me to make that admission, but I think that's where we have to start from. Let's start from the very beginning. Where are we right now? Well, President Trump confronts national and international humiliation. Why? Because, you know, he's talked incessantly about bullying and dominating Iran, about bringing it to its knees, about unconditional surrender, regime change, and so forth and so on. He did all of this at the behest of Mr. Netanyahu and the billionaire Zionists who surround Trump, who helped put him in the White House. This is not something that the United States needs to be involved with. First, we're not really dependent on the oil that comes out of there, but more important, we don't really have an interest in disrupting the world's oil supply, as we are now discovering, because the ramifications for the rest of the world, for our friends in Asia, for our friends in Europe, are catastrophic. But that's where we are. Now, if you're facing humiliation, it means that you can't change this condition. You can't alter the circumstances. We don't have the ability to do that. That's something that he refuses to admit publicly, and I imagine privately. And I think what we're looking at the moment is a five-day break during which he's trying to find a way out, but at the same time to build up this ground force designed to seize islands inside the Persian Gulf. That's about all there is to it. Now, is there any way out for him? Is there an off-ramp? Well, I think he's shut all of those with his big mouth. So that means he's got to stand up and say, I was wrong. I can't do these things. I made a decision to disengage our forces, and we will sit with the Iranians and try to put together an agreement that minimizes the harm that I've done to my own country and our allies. I don't think that's going to happen, Dan. Do you?
So, yeah, I can't imagine I would do that.
Yeah, so I don't think he's going to do that. So that means he bought 5 days. They're going to look for every way they can find. They'll turn to anybody, whether it's Pakistan or India or any country in the world that might be able to, in their view, help them. But these people, although I have no doubt that the Pakistanis, the Indians, and others are very sincere, we've reached the point now where the Iranians have no incentive to cooperate. They have no incentive to sit down and listen to us. They don't really believe anything we say, and they've got a lot of evidence to support that position. We don't carry through on what we say. We lie repeatedly. And in the midst of lying at negotiations, we set them up for attack. So I think the Iranians right now are doing what they're doing because they're waiting for something to break globally. And I think that's coming. They're also looking at us, and they're not fools. Our financial position is very weak. And it's difficult at all for our financial system to crash at this point.
Right, not actually going to cover some
finance
of
the war. What do you do?
Exactly, and I'm actually going to cover the financial aspect of this. It's obviously not part of the narrative in the Western media, and I want to touch on that because one of the other things he said in there, which is just self-evidently untrue, is he claimed that they bragged about having these nuclear materials, and instead of deterring me, that actually launched me in. Well, as we've talked about, I think you and I have, and definitely on our show last July, where Ted Postol went in and detailed 400 plus kilograms of reprocessed 60% material and the 10 to 11 bombs they could make. So it's obviously been out there in the open source for a long time. They're claiming, the president is claiming, that they discovered this in the last round of negotiations, and that's what prompted him to launch on this imminent threat, et cetera. You would think ordinarily the so-called fifth estate, to where the media in America would ask hard questions and go down the path to say, hey, these things aren't lining up, especially stuff that's gross like this. Instead, Doug, not a shock, but I just want to demonstrate it. We are seeing the exact opposite. What we're seeing is media members and members of President Trump's political friends bending over backwards to continue to tell you, yes, this war is good and we need to keep going. Here's a few examples. First of all, we're going to have Laura Ingraham on Fox News talking with the former deputy director of the NSC, a gentleman named Mr. Greenwell, who's going to say, first of all, here, you know what? I don't believe anything the Iranians say. Don't ever listen to the Iranian side. Just listen to us.
I never thought I would see this in the United States of America, but the American press, okay, seemed to believe what Iran was saying. Well, Iran is saying that they're not really talking about a deal. They kind of poo-pooed the idea of a 15-point plan that was essentially agreed to by Iran. But I guess that's where we stand now, that ABC, NBC, CNN, they'll actually take the Iranian points of view at this point seriously?
No surprise that too much of the media enterprise is sympathetic to our adversaries. Look, three quick points, and you hit the most important. The only numbers that really matter are the fact that the United States and Israel are intercepting 92% to 94% of what's left of the Iranian inventory. And second, 100% of our strikes are successful. There's nothing the Iranians can do about it. You're 100% right. It is just a matter of time. We need to let the president cook.
Yeah, we need to let the president cook because 94% of all incoming Iranian stuff is knocked out. But you know, you don't have to look very far than Dimona and Irad and Tel Aviv today in the daylight. And somehow that 94% doesn't seem to be squaring with reality.
Well, no, but then nothing does right now in terms of what the reality is presented inside the Beltway. This nonsense is going to continue. Keep two things in mind. First of all, who's paying for everything? Who owns the media? You know, who's taken ownership of these big media corporations? Where do they stand? Where are their loyalties? Well, most people on any given day in the media dislike Donald Trump, but they strongly support what he's doing to support Israel. So if you start following the money, you can answer that question pretty quickly. And if you want to keep your job at Fox News, you're going to say exactly what Laura Ingraham says. And this, of course, sets up the false argument. Well, if you don't agree with us, if you don't say what we're saying is true, that our strikes are 100% effective, nobody's airstrikes and missile strikes in human history have ever been 100% effective. And then secondly, that 92% destruction of all incoming missiles is fact. If you don't agree with that, you are not a loyal American. You are not a patriot. You are lying. You are bad. You should be suppressed. Ideally, should be jailed. I mean, this is the sort of logic train that we're on. And it's depressing, but it pays well. And that's what people need to understand. You don't get paid anything for going on the mainstream media and saying, look, based on experience, I'd be surprised if 50% of these strikes were actually effective. We're hitting a lot of decoys. We're hitting things repeatedly. Things we hit before and we didn't have the desired effect. And by the way, it looks like our interception rate is probably closer to 50% or less. You've talked to Ted Postol. You know, I've been down this road before with the United States Air Force, and I like them very much. But they have a theory that if you admit under any circumstances to missing anything, or you admit to being driven away because you can't penetrate the airspace or because you're taking heavy fire, well, then you're putting air power, quote unquote, at risk. If you do that, you're putting the future of the United States and its security at risk. Therefore, anything you say that may not be true is justified. This is crap. It's crap, and it needs to stop. But I see no evidence that anyone is going to stand up and try to stop anything at this point. Quite the contrary.
Well, in fact, let's continue on that same interview because this is bringing up and introducing a new problem for the administration. Now, President Trump was already going to have a problem when he came to the expiration of this 48-hour ultimatum that he foolishly set, because the Iranian side was ready to counter it and they were ready to go. And so far, they have done everything that they said they would do in retaliation. Now he's pushed it back 5 days, but he's only pushed it back 5 days. Now, this narrative here, going back to Greenwell, he's going to go much further than just saying something about introduction. He's saying we really don't even need to worry about negotiations because we're going to win this militarily.
He's doing a masterful job of it. He manufactured leverage. We need to let the president cook. Second, he's doing a masterful job of it. He manufactured leverage by stating we'll hit their power supply and power generation facilities if they don't stop within 48 hours. Lo and behold, we're in negotiations. And three, while he has a clear idea of where he's headed, the Iranians are an absolute chaos, mostly because their leadership's been decimated, but also because they're disconnected from one another. And so now they're arguing with themselves about how best to proceed. And in the end, I think a military solution is nearly done and will probably be the way this conflict ends.
So if he says that the military is nearly done and that's how we're going to do it, so we don't have to worry about negotiations. But what happens if we come up on Friday and they haven't negotiated, they haven't submitted, and we haven't won militarily? So what happens then?
Well, I think these negotiations are a trifle one-sided, especially since the Iranians aren't involved. That's the first point. Second point is, militarily win? What are we winning? Is this the Battleship Missouri scenario where the Iranians troop aboard the Battleship Missouri sitting somewhere in the Persian Gulf and surrendered to Donald Trump? This is all nonsense. The man's not telling the truth. He's a shill for the administration. The Beltway is full of these people. And part of the reason is that people can't imagine anything else. And you got to understand how we get here. First of all, we start something without any sort of strategic framework. What are we going to do? Well, we're going to pulverize the Iranians. Their regime is going to fall. There's a popular uprising and everything improves. We don't recognize that there are any limitations on our resources. There's no recognition that the American electorate might actually wake up and say, wait a minute, what are you doing? Their assumption is we're sheep. We'll all sleep through this. Failure to identify attainable strategic goals. What are the attainable strategic goals? Is it attainable to destroy the regime? That's failed. Are you just going to destroy the whole country, 93 million people, hundreds of thousands of square miles? Unlikely. What about your own military power? And this is very important because what we're seeing is not asymmetric warfare. What we're seeing is one side is trying to wage war the way we have certainly since about 1944. That's the old way of war. And we're facing an opponent who is waging a very different war against us. They're actually waging a war of the future in the 21st century. And that's a war of missiles, unmanned systems, as well as manned systems, a mix of everything, but maximum precision strike with a maximum of persistent surveillance. That's where we are. We're not going to win this war, not the way we're approaching it. And we can fire every last missile in our inventory, and we're going to discover that.
Now, one thing I want to ask Doug, going back again to your comment that there is from the administration and just the government itself and just the powers that be, this might be another example of that. Senator Ted Cruz, I guess a few days back, boasted in an interview that he basically talked Trump into this war. He said, I got into the beast with him, his presidential limo, and we were in Florida, and I talked to him, and I told him why this was so important, came out and agreed to do that. So first of all, Cruz took credit for convincing Trump to go. He probably has some competition with Lindsey Graham on that one, but we'll leave that for another day. But then he said this last night, that basically this has been an incredible success.
The first 3 weeks of this military conflict have been incredibly successful. In 3 weeks, we've taken out all of Iran's air defenses. We've taken out virtually every one of their short-range and medium-range ballistic missiles. We've taken out their missile production capacity. We've taken out their drone capacity. We've taken out their drone manufacturing. You look at what we've done to the Navy. We've had over 8,000 strikes in Iran and on the Navy. We have sunk more than 120 ships. This is the largest naval defeat, the most ships sunk since World War II. That's in 3 weeks. And in addition to that, we have decapitated the regime, taking out not just the Ayatollah, but the senior military leaders, the mullahs who have been tyrants in that country for 47 years. The outcome, I believe, should be simple and straightforward. We want to see a government in Iran that is not run by crazed Islamists who lead mobs chanting death to America.
So it's real simple, Doug. He just wants to see the regime change in a way that we want, even though we don't have the power to make it happen. And then to your point there, he again goes back to World War II analogy that, you know, we've sunk more ships than anything since World War II. And, of course, we used a submarine to sink an armed ship not far from India when this thing began here. And they seem to be bragging on that. And I don't know. I don't even see any evidence that anyone's aware, much less acknowledging that Iran has foreseen all this so that their actual Navy, the one that can be used in this, is underground so far and will come out at a time of their choosing to do things in the Strait if they need to. And then also they don't have an Air Force like we have because they're using missiles to pretty good effect so far. But this can't work. As you point out, you just got through making a good description of why this is not going to work. So one would imagine that, especially of an official who wants to get reelected, is not going to say something that's going to be proven to be untrue later on. But it could be that he doesn't care about that or doesn't know because he has such contempt for the electorate that they'll vote for me anyway. Which of those things do you think is at play here?
Well, I think they all apply, frankly. Senator Cruz is the same senator who couldn't tell Tucker Carlson how many people lived in Iran. I doubt seriously he'd ever looked at the size of Iran, its terrain, its geography, to appreciate the true strategic challenge associated with waging war on a civilizational state that also happens to be a continental power. So I, you know, what do you say? I wouldn't take him seriously. I think he's reading from the talking points that the White House and the Pentagon provide to all the retired generals. And again, a good example of the complete failure, excuse me, to understand the impact of change on warfare. Well, we sank their Navy. What Navy? They had seven old frigates, collection of other boats, and that hasn't stopped anyone in the Persian Gulf from interfering with the shipping traffic. So I don't know what they're talking about. There really hasn't been an Iranian Air Force to speak of since the Shah departed. So again, this is back to the failure to understand what you're dealing with. I'm most concerned at this stage by people that talk this way who are going to try and make the fallacious argument that was made recently by Lindsey Graham. President Trump, if you take Karg Island, the war's over. Right. So I have a feeling we're headed down that road. I think we're going to pay a horrendous price for that stupidity. But maybe that's unavoidable. Now, finally, you said, well, what's the problem? There are a lot of people out there, particularly in my generation, they watch the mainstream media. They believe whatever they're told. You would think at some point they would say, wait a minute, this is all nonsense. You would think somebody would wake up and say, wait a minute, President Trump, I voted for you. You haven't done what you said you were going to do. What happened to the effort to deal with the illegal alien problem in the United States? What are you doing to enforce federal law? By the way, 300,000 children in the United States effectively disappear every year. Is anybody doing anything about that? Why aren't we doing something about it? We're not killing 300,000 children or Americans in the Persian Gulf, but if we're losing 300,000 children inside the United States, I'd say that's a pretty big emergency. Doesn't come up for discussion. Nobody's paying for that. The whole thing is disgraceful. It's disgusting. But it's where we are. And eventually, Americans are going to have to change this. But it's like everything else. It probably has to get worse before people wake up, smell the coffee, and demand change.
And, you know, we have a lot of these World War II imagery because we love those. Because, you know, we won World War II. You know, we were the only ones that won. We can talk about that another day here, but it looks like Vietnam War is another one that we'd like to replicate, although I'm not sure why, since that didn't work out so well. But I mean, here's a couple of things. These are officially released CENTCOM charts. This is as of information from yesterday, and they're bragging about all these different assets you can see on the screen here. These are all the things we bring to the fight to show how incredible it is on the air, land, and sea, and we're just doing all this destruction. And then you see that those things have targets struck, 9,000 targets, combat flights, 9,000 plus, Iranian vessels damaged or destroyed, 140. So it's this statistics that we want to show. But then the question is, What do these statistics translate into on the ground?
Well, historically, the generals, and I imagine the admirals are in the same category, tend to understand only what they can count. They're very impressed by numbers. And this, of course, is extremely dangerous and misleading, particularly if you go back to Vietnam. I was listening to this discussion by Greenway about all these boats or ships or whatever they are that we claim that we sank in the Navy. I remember people talking about how many sampans we'd blown out of the water, on the Mekong River and the Mekong Delta. I served under officers who actually witnessed all sorts of insanity to the extent that we didn't get a high enough body count in the last battle. So we went out and chopped the dead in half. Then we doubled the count, the body count. I mean, this sort of thing is depressing, but it seems to be a feature of the American military. If you can't quantify it, it doesn't mean anything. It's back to Schwarzkopf. How many tanks had we destroyed today? How many artillery pieces did? No. Then we found out that a lot of that was deception too. During the Kosovo air campaign, we saw the same thing. Oh, we destroyed hundreds of this and hundreds of that. It was all nonsense. 11 tanks, 12 self-propelled guns, 90 other assorted pieces of equipment, mostly wheeled, for 78 days of the air campaign. What kind of nonsense is that? In other words, it's all meaningless. And they don't know what else to do. They don't have an answer. And sadly, what they've done is they've said, okay, we're going to replicate Rolling Thunder. Rolling Thunder failed in Vietnam. This massive Air Force campaign, what did we do? We introduced ground forces. And how did that turn out? When the first people landed in Vietnam, in South Vietnam, went ashore, they didn't even know what the objective was. It took time to figure out where they were going to go and what they were going to attack. It stayed that way for 8 years until we finally got the hell out. And I think we're going to find the same thing is true, because these people are looking for something that doesn't exist. It's back to the Karg Island argument. If we take Karg Island, we win the war. Come on. Not the way it works. It's never worked that way. They're looking for the silver bullet that's going to deliver victory, that will enable them to take credit for something good and then essentially disappear over the horizon until the next fiasco. I don't think it's going to work this time.
Well, yeah, and actually that's exactly what I want to talk about, because we see that one of the potential coincidences is that the USS Tripoli, with its amphibious landing dock, USS New Orleans, and the 2,200 Marines will be on the 31st. We will be on station on Friday when that second deadline ends. There's also 82nd Airborne Troops, a brigade, I think, at least in here. There's another, the 11th Marine Expeditionary Unit, steaming in with the USS Boxer. So the question is, what are they going to do? And can you just give us a little sense for whether it's Karg Island or something else? I personally think that Karg Island is just a deception operation. I don't think anybody's actually going to go there because the difficulty would be too high. I don't know. Maybe they will. But whatever. You're talking maybe 5,000 Marines with the two MEUs and another few thousand from the 82nd Airborne. What can those organizations, what can that much ground combat power, along with the A-10s and the Apache helicopters, which have been sent over to support whatever they're going to do on the ground, what is feasible militarily for them to do?
It's important for Americans to understand something. What you do as a soldier, sailor, airman, or Marine after you arrive is much more important than how fast you get there. Right now, the emphasis is on light and fast. Why are we sending a brigade for the 82nd? Well, because we can. You load up 3,000 men. Now, of course, the Army, as always, has said, well, if we're going to send a brigade, we have to have a division headquarters on the ground to manage it. So 3,000 troops need a two-star general with a one-star general as a deputy and probably 150, 200, maybe more people to plan and conduct operations. This is a sort of standard, you know, World War II nonsense that we go through. And then the Marines. We're going to put Marines there because we can float them in, and then we can put them somewhere. Well, the problem is once you put the paratrooper on the ground, once you put the Marine on the ground, the Ranger, whoever it is, what are they going to do? What can they do? Are they going to seize and hold something of great value? What is the seizure about? if they go to an island, can they hold that island? Well, I think we're finding out that islands are extremely vulnerable. Unless it's the size of Borneo, that means that all sorts of precision strike missiles and unmanned systems can annihilate everything on the island. So if you think you're going to go on an island and then hold it for what? What's the benefit? How does it help you? And see, from the Iranian standpoint, they're probably sitting there asking themselves, how could we be this stupid? And we shouldn't get confused. We're not saying that Marines or soldiers or anybody else are not good, solid people that are well-trained and reasonably well-led, I hope, and disciplined. It's not the point. Is what are they going to do when they get there? And how much can you expect of them? So that's why I go back to this thing of, well, we'll seize the islands. Now, if you look at the straits, and this is very hot, very important. I just wrote a piece on Substack that goes into some detail on this. If you know, you go through all the thinking and then you say, well, I'm going to introduce ground troops and I'm going to seize the straits. What does that mean? If you look at the sides of the strait, in other words, the coastline, you're talking about 1,000 feet of cliff. In other words, this is an uphill climb in the worst sense of the word. Are you then going to land troops further to the east and then make the long march around to take it from the landward side? I mean, what are you doing? If you're going to put them on an island, once they're sitting on the island, what kind of control or influence are they going to assert? And the answer is none, because the place will be pulverized. It'll be covered by rockets and missiles. Anything on it will be exterminated. I mean, that's the easy thing to do. What else would you do? Now, of course, if you're going to make the argument that the Iranians are running out of missiles, which reminds me of the Russian army running out of missiles and rockets and so forth, then maybe it's fine. Maybe you could go there and open the chaise lounge chair and take in some sun. But the point is, I don't think so. And I don't think that you can stop from 150 kilometers away all sorts of weapons being launched against those sites. And again, we're back to persistent surveillance. What are you going to do that's going to fool anybody? Where are you going to stage forces? Are you going to try and stage them in Kuwait, in Bahrain? Are you going to try and stage out of Oman? I doubt seriously the Omanis will be receptive to that idea. Are you going to try and stage out of the UAE? Anywhere you go where you try to mass forces, it's going to be picked up, it's going to be targeted, and you're going to be brought under effective fire. So the problem with all of this is, do we have these capabilities? Yeah, we got lots of light infantry. Much of it's good. It'll go where you send it. But what are you asking it to do? And I think at the moment, we're asking them to do the impossible, to exert control over geography that they can't control. It's not a question of, are there not enough of them? It's simply a question of surveillance and strike. And if you don't have that advantage, if you can't rob the enemy of ISR, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, and you can't defeat his intermediate range or tactical ballistic missiles and so forth, what are you going to do? Perhaps we're going to have to go through this in order to learn this lesson the hard way.
And just real briefly, what about this? Because there's a lot of things swirling around and a lot of the rumor mills that actually these troops, especially these light fighters, are actually being sent to do a seizure operation to get those 400 kilograms of reprocessed material and prevent Iran from ever turning them into a nuclear bomb. What is the possibility? We have a lot of good people that can do things. We've seen how SEAL Team 6 went and took out bin Laden. We've seen how we just took Maduro out here. Can something like that work?
Well, there's gold in the Amazon jungles. Why don't you go find it? Good luck. I mean, you're looking for the proverbial needle in a haystack. Now, you can try and detect things using satellite imagery as well as other means of detection overhead to see whether or not you found something that's radioactive. but I'm not sure you're going to end up with what you're looking for. It doesn't take that much material to alert somebody in space or flying overhead. What if you alert on 15, 20 places? Do you line them up and go to them in succession? How do you get there? Are you going to fly in a helicopter? Helicopters are so vulnerable. You can knock them down with rocks. You know, so how do you get in and get out without being detected? And that's the biggest problem I have with all of these assumptions. The other thing is, I read recently, somebody said, we may need as many as 200,000 troops. If you go back to the Dardanelles in 1915, it started really in earnest in February of 1915. It lasted for 9 months. They went in initially, these are the straits between Turkey and Europe, what we call the Bosporus. And the idea was that you seize the straits so that you could pass the Royal Navy through. They can then take Constantinople, now Istanbul, under direct fire. You can land more troops and seize the capital and knock the Turks out of the First World War. It was very attractive. Everybody thought this was a great idea. Well, not everybody. The chief of naval operations thought it was insane, but Churchill, who was effectively the Secretary of the Navy, overrode him and said, no, this will be successful. Churchill did these kinds of things routinely. If he didn't agree, he just dismissed expert opinion and then would go off on these tangents and do incredibly stupid things. The Dardanelles operation was a good example. And there were something like 20 forts, fortified positions, up and down the straits the Turks had built with heavy artillery. Then on top of that, you had over 300,000 Turkish troops that showed up. Beyond that, you had mines of all different types and kinds, mines that sank three battleships and numerous other supporting vessels. Ultimately, they ended up with 500,000 men on the Gallipoli Peninsula, 500,000 troops, mostly British, some New Zealanders, some Australians, British Indian Division, which seldom gets mentioned. It deserves credit. They fought well. And some Frenchmen, 500,000 men. It was a disaster because, once again, you were going uphill. And the Turks held the high ground. The Turks lost 87,000 men killed. I don't know how many the British and others lost, but it's probably pretty close to that.
48,000, actually. I looked that up the other day.
The Turks won. The Turks won. And how could they lose? It was impossible to defeat them, given the terrain and the circumstances. So what I'm trying to get across is, you know, people seem to have read the story of the Dardanelles, but they didn't read the whole way through. They read the first few chapters, said, oh, this is a great idea, let's do it. Didn't bother to read the concluding chapter, which was catastrophic failure. It was a dumb idea. What they're talking about trying to do with ground troops in the Straits of Hormuz, in my judgment, is an equally dumb idea. Unless, of course, I could be wrong about this, you have annihilated all of the intermediate range and tactical ballistic missiles, cruise missiles. You have eliminated all of the unmanned systems that could be basically launched and hurled at you, so that the place is barren. And then, even more important, perhaps you can jam all the satellites, Chinese and Russian and others, that are providing assistance and support and imagery to the Iranians. If you can do all of those things, then I suppose you can put people on the ground with rifles walking around looking at the neighborhood. Will that give you control of the straits? Well, that depends on whether or not you got all the underwater unmanned vessels and systems, whether you have killed sufficient numbers of speedboats, whether or not, you know, go down the list.
Yeah.
Everybody forgets that before we went into Normandy, there was almost no German air force left in Western Europe. Everybody forgets this. You know, we wanted to land in 1942. Then we wanted to land in 43. And each time the British wisely distracted us and said, forget it. We have no chance of coming ashore. There's an event called Dieppe. Some of your listeners or in the audience may want to go look this up. In 1942, the Canadians insisted ferociously, we know we can beat the Germans. Let us land. And they landed with a few thousand men, and they were slaughtered. And they brought tanks and everything else, and they were destroyed. And the Germans sank everything. By the time we landed in Normandy in June of 1944, there were only two fighters in the German Air Force capable of lifting off and fighting us. In 1943, before this had occurred, there were hundreds of fighters, even thousands left that could have done enormous damage to us, and thousands of top flight troops. But everything was on the Eastern Front. There wasn't much left in the West. And what was there? Well, it just wasn't top of the line. We don't even point these things out. We don't understand how things really went down. And by the way, even with all the advantages that we had created, we had 5,000 fighters in the air over Normandy. Even with that, the Germans held us up for over a month. And at one point, it looked like they could drive us into the sea. So we need to understand these kinds of operations are extremely dangerous, very difficult to conduct. And I hope somebody somewhere is telling these things to the president.
Yeah, we certainly do as well. Listen, I'm going to spend the remainder of the time here on talking a different set of tactics and details. The statistics put by CENTCOM a minute ago, we're talking about how many assets we have, how many targets we've hit, and all that kind of stuff. There's another set of statistics they didn't talk anything about, which I would like to, and that is in the economic realm. First of all, because of what's already happened to the LNG capacities that have been hit by Qatar, it's already going to take up to 5 years to replace that. And that's assuming that nothing else happens from this point forward. You also have not just the oil that's trying to get out of the Strait of Hormuz, but you have other things that have to do with global fertilizer trade, sulfur, urea, ammonia, and several other kind of things. You see, if you can see on that screen there, 47% of the sulfur and 24% of the ammonia and everything else in between, 35% of the urea for the world economic for the world agricultural needs go through the straits every day. You also have this issue here that the United States government, according to a new report, this hasn't been talked about much because everybody's been talking about the war, but we kind of need to talk about it a little bit. This is the one I want to camp on here because I think that it has the most impact on what may be driving the U.S. to try and get this fixed. The U.S. government is insolvent. That's not hyperbole. That is the conclusion drawn directly from a Treasury Department's consolidated financial statements for the fiscal year released last week to near total media silence. The number is $6.06 trillion in total assets against $47 trillion in total liabilities as of last September. If the $84 trillion in 75-year off-balance sheet obligations were added to that, then the total liabilities would now exceed $136 trillion, roughly five times the U.S. annual GDP. Then the most important part. Most people cannot relate to the trillion-dollar figures as a government ledger, so consider this. Divide every number by 100 million, drop eight zeros, and federal finances look like a household budget in freefall. That household earns $52,000 and spends $73,000, running a $20,000 annual deficit. Its total liabilities and unfunded promises amount to $1.3 million against just $60,000 in assets, leaving it $1.3 million in the hole. This would be if you were somebody who only makes $50,000. That's the scale here. And Uncle Sam, by any accounting standard, is insolvent. So how can we continue on with these wars, Doug, that do nothing but cost us? We've already got $200 billion more in supplemental on the table here. Where is this leaving us as a country, and what if we don't get this fixed?
Well, first of all, we're not going to fix it, Dan. It's beyond fixing. Secondly, we're dealing with President Trump, who is engaged in something that people frequently call the gambler's fallacy. In other words, the belief that despite the losses at the tables, he can go in and win everything back on one big throw. Do you understand? In other words, roll the dice one more time, and this time it'll work, and we'll win everything. This gambler's fallacy is not unusual. That was, unfortunately, Hitler's mentality at the beginning of the invasion of the Soviet Union. He acknowledged some of the things that were told to him by the general staff that urged him not to invade, and tried to explain there were far more troops than he thought there were, that just because they had performed badly in Finland, the Soviet military was resilient, and mass purges had ultimately raised up younger officers who might have waited years to be promoted, who would be effective in battle. He didn't listen to these things, and he didn't listen to his own liabilities. They went into the Soviet Union with 50% of the air power that they had used against the British and French and the Low Countries. The reason I'm saying this is that I think this is at work right now. Remember that historically, until we went off the gold standard, you had to raise taxes to pay for wars. Well, the wonderful benefit of coming off the gold standard was that you could just print money. You didn't have to raise taxes, which meant that you could wage war on the sly. That became even more true when we abolished the draft, because the draft was the real issue at the end of the Vietnam War. People realized there's nothing over in Vietnam or in Southeast Asia for which we should die. There's no interest there that justifies it. So then you had to go to a quote-unquote volunteer force, which for many years was a real problem, as you may or may not know, but I was there in the 70s. It was rough. It didn't really improve until we went through this terrible recession under Carter, and we were flooded with a lot of talent, good human capital. And that, more than anything else, helped us enormously to improve the armed forces, particularly in the Army. Now, my point is that this has no chance of success right now. And they're in a race. I think Donald Trump is in a race. Can I win this war on one dramatic throw? It's the gambler's fallacy. Can I somehow or another miraculously escape? I'm a man of great luck and good fortune. Can I pull this out at the last minute before it all falls apart? More importantly, before the economic dimension comes home to roost, before the financial system demands attention. I don't think it'll happen that way. And right now, for instance, if you look at all the things that petroleum is part of, look at the plastics industries, those in particular, something like a garbage bag that we take for granted. We're talking about fertilizer, which is having a terrible impact in India and China and other countries. It's going to have an impact on crops and production of foodstuffs. But if you look at something like garbage bags, you better stock up on them, because we're going to have a shortage of those. And I think a lot of the shortages that you're implying, we will begin to feel acutely in the summer. It's not going to be nice. It's going to be ugly. And other people are saying, you know, if you got a problem with your automobile, the supply chains are going to break down as a result of everything we've done. You better go out and get your automobile fixed now, because later on, the parts won't be on hand to fix them. I mean, it's a nightmare. It's going to be somewhat like COVID, only I suspect worse. And it's not something from which we will recover quickly. So I think Donald Trump knows that in private. Now, Scott Bessent, you know, he was asked, how are you going to pay for it? Oh, well, that's ridiculous. We could pay for everything. You can't pay for everything if the people won't lend you the money to do it. Nobody wants to buy our debt. And our currency is being debased. So old Scott Bessent is going to be held responsible and accountable for what he said recently about, oh, it's ridiculous. Not a problem at all. We could pay for this and in perpetuity. Not a problem. He's wrong. So we're sort of headed into the perfect storm. And the only part of it that President Trump can directly influence is the part he doesn't want any part of, and that is disengage from the war in the Middle East. End it. Get out. Admit that you miscalculated. It was a mistake. But he doesn't want to end up like our friend Donald, well, it's not Donald Rumsfeld too, but more important, Robert McNamara. And remember, he said, well, we just didn't understand the culture. No, there were plenty of people around to explain it. They didn't listen. And the people in this White House are not listening. They never have, because they are like Enron, the smartest men in the room.
That's a tough analogy there. So where does this leave us, that Doug? Because right now we have we're now what, I guess 3 days away from the end of the second ultimatum, because which is still on the table. We have a lot of ground combat power going in, which, as you just articulated, can't accomplish anything. It's a tiny amount for the massive scale that's going on here. We have the economic problems going on. We have the price of oil that's down today because they listened to President Trump, but that's going to expire at the end of this week. It's either going to drop further if there's a negotiated deal, or it's going to spike up higher if Trump starts attacking and then Iran attacks elsewhere in response. So we truly, you said it's a perfect storm. I think that's it. Where do you think this go? Because some of this stuff's coming up near term where we're going to have to either crap or get off the pot.
Well, I think we're going to crap ourselves first. And that's coming after the pause that we're involved with right now ends. How soon after it ends? I don't know. I would think certainly the week after next, we should see some serious action. I'm sure we'll double down on our bombing campaign. We'll try to hit more of the same things over and over and over again. And then that'll be it. And we'll probably employ these ground forces in some capacity. And we'll try to do it in a way that we think will create the illusion of success or victory. I mean, that's what it's all about. We're not substantively changing anything anymore.
And Doug, let me just ask here on this point, what if we are unable to spin anything? What if we try something on the ground and actually suffer mass casualties and don't even, we can't even spin it into a success? What happens then?
Well, I don't think that President Trump's argument or the argument of others in his administration that this is effectively, well, this is the price of war, is going to work, because people are going to ask the hard question, for what? Why are we doing it? Why did we do it? How do we benefit? And oh, by the way, everything here at home is falling apart. So I don't think it looks good. That's why I started this hour by saying President Trump confronts the very, very high probability of certain humiliation internationally and nationally. So I think there's a serious problem insofar as his longevity in office is concerned. I don't know how long he'll be able to stand the pressure and the heat in the kitchen, so to say. There will be people that will demand his removal. And it's going to be tough on the people that have worked with him. Then you add to it what we were discussing at the beginning of the hour, the Hunter Biden levels of corruption. This is beginning to have an effect. People are beginning to notice.
Yeah,
takes a while, but they do. You can't fool all the people all the time, but you can fool some of the people some of the time. I think we're running out of some of those people, but okay. It's still too soon. We'll see.
We will see, and we'll continue to watch it. And other people don't have to wait for you to be on our show next time. You have a Substack out there with your latest one on this issue of Gallipoli, Straits of Hormuz, America's Gallipoli. We recommend people go to your Substack. Where can they find you?
Well, it's mcgregorwarrior.substack.com. And it's very easy to find, and I urge people to read this one. It's an important one. The last two that I published before this were equally important. We're trying to go through and explain, how do you make all of these mistakes? Well, you mirror image. You pretend the enemy is like you, thinks like you, behaves like you. That's why you heard Witkoff, for instance, say, "Oh, the president and I were talking, and we pounded these people, and we had all of this great military power out there, and we thought, well, we'd get a deal." No, you know, it's just silly nonsense. We're dealing with people that don't know what they're doing. That's the bottom line.
And it's embarrassing, because that first clip I showed you where you had Laura Ingraham mocking people for even listening to the Iranian side. Instead, they want to keep that in their mind that you just said, that they just think like we do because that's convenient for us, but their actions aren't quite making it up that. But as you say, we'll continue to watch and see where this goes. Thank you so much for being on the show today, Doug. As always, really appreciate these analogies you painted.
Sure. Thanks, Dan.
And we appreciate you guys, too. As a reminder, we are on Substack. We ourselves are also on our podcast we have, because some people I know like to get that. Be sure and share this with you folks. We are unintimidated and uncompromised to bring you the truth that you just aren't getting on mainstream media. It's becoming more and more evident by the day. Be sure and just Google Daniel Davis Deep Dive. Wherever you get your podcast, you'll find us there. You can find us on Substack, DanielDavisDeepDive.substack.com. And of course, you can share this here, too. Be sure and do that, and we will look forward to seeing you at 1 o'clock with Jim Jatras on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.